This episode is brought to you by Dr. Marty Mushrooms. Are you looking to boost your health and wellness? Dr. Marty has created some incredible functional mushroom supplements that are taking over the market and showing some amazing results. So whether you're looking for support for your brain and nervous system, immunity, sleep, gut health, or more, this really is for you. Personally, I've been using it to improve my sleep, and I found that I'm no longer waking up at 3 a.m. in the morning and having a great night's sleep. Dr. Marty Mushrooms focuses on the philosophy of prevention rather than cure, emphasizing the importance of incorporating these supplements into your daily routines. So for all of our expansive listeners, head over to DocMarty.com and use the code EXPANSIVE20 to get 20% off your very first order. That's EXPANSIVE20 for 20% off from your first order. Hi, and welcome to The Expansive. Today, you are joining us for a very special episode. It's called The Expansive Friends. That was the theme we gave it last time, right? Expansive Friends, because Rich came on and he was like, it can't be Friends of The Expansive, it needs to be Expansive Friends, and we had to rebrand and go through the whole thing.
It's so unlike Richard to come in and blow shit up and then restructure it. That's not Richard at all. He never goes against the grain. I mean, how's that we invite a podcast guest and he tells us, the way you've named your podcast is wrong. Let me help you change it. That's Richie. That's why we have him back. Welcome, Richard. How are you, my friend?
You did indeed. I am an expansive individual. You know what it is, guys? It's just that I want to feel more associated with you than I am. It's my way of carving out that I am somehow in the inner circle of expansiveness. And so one day when Expansive becomes the biggest global network of thinkers in the world, I will be there as one of the kind of honorary guests.
Yes, you definitely are.
Yes, absolutely. You're the OG of public speaking, bro. You triggered it off for me. So yes, you are somehow that sort of first sort of the light in the sort of world for us. But it's awesome to have you back again. It's fantastic. Already we've been off air for like 10 minutes having a big laugh about all sorts of different things. And we want to give a quick shout out to Mozambique today for us highly sort of coming in high on the charts for Mozambique. So thank you so much, everybody out there. Taj Bopa, Botardes, Bon Dias. As I've just learned in Portugal when I was just there. But we got a great topic today, and I couldn't think of anybody better to really talk about it. And it's really just the future of presenting and showing up in a world of AI and human connection. But before we get to that, Eric, you wanted to kick things off in a way with some deep research that you did, you were saying.
Yeah. Let's just jump straight into it. I came across a very interesting article this week because, we all involved in the world of corporates, and I think mainly what we are trying to do is we're trying to help shape how people think about leadership and teams and speaking and building for the future. And so we're all involved in this process of helping them to learn new skills and new ways of thinking. And I came across this very interesting article about a new trend, and it's a trend called pod walking, which of course makes total sense for us speaking about this on the pod. And the idea is that, especially for hybrid teams, is that you choose a podcast. So there's four steps to it. You choose a podcast, you block out lunch so you can go for a walk, you listen to the pod on your walk, and then directly afterwards, you have a debrief where you get to talk about this podcast and then kind of think about what are the insights that apply to us, and then rinse and repeat. And I thought it was really interesting that companies are starting to do this. It made me very excited, and I'll tell you why. I think there's a huge opportunity for podcasters actually with this sort of trend emerging. But I thought I want to get two sort of lines of thinking from you guys. But the first is just, what do you think about pod walks? So,
I don't know if I've chatted to one or both of you about it, but I have recorded like four or five episodes. I want to get like 50 of them going, but it's quite funny because it's somewhat similar but different. It's the idea of, let's call it pod walking. I've never heard the term before, but a commuter podcast. And what it does is to get you into the frame of reference of being at work or being at home. And the idea is that it's a 15-minute walk you do if you work from home. And so at the beginning of every episode, I ask one question. I just say, hey, welcome to this morning's walk, blah, 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 blah. Here's a question I want to pose for you. And I might tell a short little story and then just pose a question. And then all I want that to do is to trigger thought. There is basically just the sounds of nature. So wherever you're walking, you have it. And then 7.5 minutes later, it says, hey, you should probably turn back around now. And then you walk back home, and 30 seconds before you get there, say, so given what you just thought about, what is the first thing you want to do when you get to work this morning? And then I want to do the exact same thing for people leaving. So it's not quite the same thing, but it's the idea of using a tool to create a commute, an audio commute for people to get them into the zone of work or out of the zone of work. In fact, I should say into the zone of home.
I think what your use case is a great example. What I was thinking about as well is that if you're a podcaster, you should really be thinking about how do you not just take your content and have it, because essentially what's happening is they're choosing content at random. Like it might be this week, I like this episode of a podcast this week, like next week is another podcast, another episode. What about you create more structured mini courses that those teams go through? And I think there's huge value in that, where like it's over the course of a few weeks, we are all walking and listening to the same content. But that it's very directed towards a problem that we might have in the business. And so it's not just kind of random education, but we're using this tool to make some real change happen for wherever we might see some improvement needed. I think it actually has me really pumped up. I think we should like definitely be doing this. Both from a paid point of view, I think clients would pay for this, but I also think just from a lead gen point of view, and we've often spoken about how do we take what's in the expansive already and how do we just create tracks, because you already have so much leadership and teams and whatever content. So how do you just create little tracks for people to jump into and, oh, like now this is themed and not just random?
There's beauty in disparate learning, because you want your team to all know different things, right? So everybody can make everybody else smarter. And then there's beauty of shared learning, where those different opinions impact on the shared body of knowledge that they've learned. So every Monday, we all watch a TED Talk. The only reason it's usually a TED Talk is because it's a nice length to watch. But we watch a 25-minute talk that has to be, we have a whole thing you have to fill out, and that gets filled out by Friday, and on Monday we talk about it. And the idea is that we have a shared context for which to chat. And of course, it's invariable that some people love it, some people hate it. Sometimes a talk that has been, I thought that was absolutely horrific, other people are like, that is my favorite talk I've ever seen. And it's changed my view on everything. So I love the idea of having almost that. Sometimes we listen to different things, although we listen to different things anyway. We don't have to mandate that. But then we have discussions around shared topics from different perspectives is where you start understanding the real thinking inside your organization, because you have that central point from which to draw from. I think it's an amazing idea. I love it.
What has been the impact in Missing Link? Because you've done this, you've done a version of this. So what do you think is the impact of having a team watch a piece of content, discussing it, and then looking at the application of that in the business?
So the number one thing for us, now let's be honest here, it's not a bit of content. It is a talk, and we do sell presentations for a living. So what it means is that every single person in our team, because nobody is immune, right? So every single person has to watch it. Every single person in our team has an opinion about what makes a good presentation. That means any Missing Link staff member you speak to is, and I want to say an expert, but when you consider that in a year you've done 52 talk teardowns, you have heard the opinions of multiple presentation coaches and strategists. Even our accountant probably knows more about presenting. I would argue our accountant certainly knows more about presenting well than the average corporate person who presents. This means that we eat, sleep, and breathe a certain way of thinking, and by curating the content and talks, because we're also quite, there's always a double whammy, right? We learn about the talk and we learn from the talk. And so one part is curating the talks that we bring in, because we want people to learn about grit and growth mindsets and things like this. But then we learn from the talk in that, how was it presented? What do we learn there? And so curating that helps you create the culture of your organization, because you're helping shape the way the people inside it think. And you're helping to show what is important there, I believe. So having a shared pool of learning and knowledge, I think, is critical to culture building. I will say, though, and maybe this, I don't want to segue too early, but we created AtomicTalks.com for a very specific reason. And it's a free service. And it's basically that we must be careful as leaders in our business that we don't always outsource the smart shit to other humans. So at Missing Link, often I've read way more books. And I used to buy the books for my staff and say, hey, you should read a copy of this and things like that. But people who are different, you know, they don't all think about the same things all day long. And that's why some of us start businesses and some of us work. And I think that's important. So what I realized is, well, then I could run a little video or a TED talk of somebody talking about this content, or I could put my spin on it. So I'd like to think of all three of, you know, both of you were standing talking to your teams and you'd read maybe two different books with polarizing ideas. Instead of you running both those videos for your team, you would stand up and say, hey, this is what I thought about, and this is this. Now, the good thing about that is then I am perceived, I know it sounds weird, but because I've added my opinion onto the learning, I'm perceived as the leader. I'm perceived as the thinker. I think too many leaders outsource authority to other experts instead of being the ones who bring the authority to you.
When you say experts, do you mean within the team or from outside of the company?
Let's say I've read either one of your books, okay? And or either one of many of your books. And I wanted to turn around and I could basically say, here's a video of, let's say, Eric, you know, chatting about action, not words, and why it's so important and things like this. And that would be great. And then everyone would turn around and say, oh, this Eric guy is an expert. But what if I turn around and said, this week I read a fascinating book and I want to share with you a couple of the key learnings I picked up from it. And I want to have a discussion around what this means to our business. The book is called Action Nonverba and it's by Eric Kruger. And I want to chat about some of the principles about, because what really struck me is the core tenets of the idea that it is not about the words that we say, it's about the actions that we do. And that's why I didn't want to just run a video of Eric's words. I wanted to discuss how we can put some of these concepts into action. So let's take 50 minutes today. I'm going to share with you three key principles. Now, let me tell you what happens there. They will remember Eric. They'll remember Action Nonverba, but they will always remember. One day they'll be sitting in a meeting and they'll say something like, you know, as my boss Richard always says, action, you know, Action Nonverba, action is louder than words. So at some point we are, and that's what happens when we do talks. None of us pretend that, in fact, don't hire me of all the ideas of my own. That's a far too limited pool. I am a curator of ideas that I synthesize, bring together and put my chef's hat on with. But people don't, even though I attribute everything with a quote, the amount of times I'm quoted as saying it's hard to read the label from inside the bottle.
Me too.
Which I have never not attributed to Howard Mann. But it's the people remember that way. So as leaders, I think we have to be very, very careful about how much of the smart stuff we outsource.
But do you think that's even Howard Mann's quote?
Well, it doesn't matter.
Because I've heard that just before. But that's kind of my point, is that it's just like it's what like turtles all the way down. It's just that, you know, the attribution layers keep going. And so like every person appropriates ideas from other people. And even if you do assign like references and whatever, it still gets attributed to you down the line.
What's that term? Is it Churchillian creep? Is that the term? And it basically says that any quote given long enough will eventually be attributed to Churchill.
To Winston Churchill.
Yeah. Or Einstein. I've also heard that with Einstein. Einstein's also been quoted many times.
Yeah. Instead of putting anonymous on a quote, just put that. So I don't even think if it matters. So the reason I attribute to Howard Mann, for me, is that in absence of any original source, because that's possibly... Howard Mann is certainly the person who popularized it for me, and I'm happy to do that. I guess the idea is you're right. Howard brought it to me, therefore to me, Howard is that expert. I brought it to my staff, so to other people, I am that expert. And I just think that this is one of the real reasons to spend more time as leaders communicating to our teams, because then we become the leaders who are smart. And the reason we created Atomic Talks was that, and again, it's 100% free. It's just that I believe wholeheartedly that if we can take the top business books, turn them into talks, get leaders to present those to their teams, we give them the videos, the coaching, the slides, everything, then leaders will start seeing the benefit of delivering speeches. And then eventually they'll approach us and say, hey, can you help me with some thought leadership?
You know, I remember over COVID-19, where we had President Cyril giving a talk to the nation every week. And I remember the unity that it brought to the country. It's almost like we needed that unity. And the minute COVID ended, he stopped speaking weekly. And I was like, what a lost opportunity to have our president stand up and just tell us what he's thinking, what he's doing, why he's doing it. And so that sort of is such an important thing for a leader to do, to consistently talk to the people that he's leading or she's leading. And in times of crisis, do it twice a day. Like, do it as often as possible so that people are having this constant North Star that you're continuously working through. And then when you have the sort of back end of Atomic Talks and having all that sort of information, just adds so much value to it. So I love that as a segue, because now we're talking about leaders communicating more often with their staff, positioning themselves at that sort of thought leadership space. And so if we go into the topic today of speaking in the future, presenting in the future, and this goes all the way from entrepreneurs selling their businesses, not selling them, but selling the products they're selling to other people and investors, to corporates who are doing talks as well, and then to keynote speakers who are speaking on stage as a profession. I wanted to really expand on this idea of what it means speaking, what is it going to look like in the future as we move into the world of AI? And I've got some ideas myself, but I could think of nobody better than to be speaking to you, Richard, about this. And what are your thoughts around where we're going? What's it going to look like? And what should we be doing to prepare?
I think out of the three of us, you've been in the game the longest, right? I mean, I know you're very, very gray, but you're not that old. Like, you are...
I heard in the last episode... I don't want to venture... Sorry, yes, I missed it. I'm a year older than John, so I'm turning 50 in October.
I got it. All right. How long have you been speaking for?
Since my son was born. The year my son was born, and he's 21. That's how I always know.
Okay.
So 21 years.
So I think what I'd love to know as we... is to maybe backtrack first. Is like, when you started speaking 21 years ago... how is that even just different from today?
I want to close the loop quickly. I'm going to come back to this question. I feel I derailed us, and I just want to very, very quickly just close the loop on pod walking, and then just because I could do it later. But I think all I'm saying to leaders is, by all means, embrace pod walking. I think it's wonderful. But instead of just coming back into the room and just saying, hey, what did we think about this? Prepare 3 or 4 slides. Get up and start the conversation. Issue what you took from it. Trigger it and hold it. Be the leader presenting it. Don't just make it a free-for-all. It's okay to stand up and speak. We've been told this whole thing around great leaders listen, but I don't think that's true. I think great leaders listen, but what makes you a leader is that you speak. If you show me, if you type in the word Google, type in the word on Google, leaders, I will show you a series of people with their fist in the air in front of an audience. Right? The difference between a leader and a manager is your ability to communicate. So if you're a manager, by all means, just let people listen and manage the conversation. But if you're a leader, open it to speak. So sorry. I just want to make sure that I didn't completely mess up the last bits on the pod walking.
And I'd like to just add one thing to that, which is that what I love about the pod walking idea, apart from the learning that happens, is that you are building a learning ritual into your team. And usually when I look at... when we work with teams, we do a bit of a survey, almost 60 to 70% of teams tell us that they don't have dedicated time for learning and development. And it often makes sense to me that those teams are so stuck in reactivity and in survival mode. It's all just about putting out the fires and trying to get to the end of the day. Like, it's not really about being proactive, changing perspective. And ultimately, what does learning do for us as a team when we do it in this fashion? Is we create those shared mental models. And those shared mental models help us to operate as a more cohesive unit and ultimately improve our performance. So what's more important than like the medium that you consume actually here is the fact that you're creating a ritual for learning. And that like now you are being a lot more intentional with this idea of continuous learning that we all pay a lot of lip service to, but when you go and dig into what's happening in organizations, often, like, the continuous learning isn't really learning. It's sort of pseudo-learning.
You know, the thing also that corporate learning has always been about watching a video and answering some questions that nobody wants to do. Nobody. That's the worst way to, like, everybody's pretending they're doing that and nobody's really doing it. So I think adding this sort of aspect into it where you're being active, you're listening to something, it's a very different way of learning and I like it. It's just adding more value to it. It's definitely a better way of me learning. I remember my ex-girlfriend used to pay her son to watch all the videos and answer the questions on her behalf because she was like, I don't feel like doing any of this. Yeah. And this is a common practice with most corporates.
One thing I'd like to add just from our lessons. So we have a format that we think that everybody should watch a talk. When you go to a talk, there's certain questions you should answer. I think this would be true for pod walking. The first thing is, what did they win you with? At what point did you get hooked? Okay, because that's a very interesting point at a talk. But again, in a podcast episode, you're like, ooh, when they started talking about this, that really turned me on. The next question we asked is, at what point did they lose you, if they did? Because there is a bit where you're like, oh, okay, cool. I didn't really get that stuff. And sometimes somebody else may say, oh, I love that bit, but that's okay. It's just that this is the bit in which you realize you weren't interested as an accountant, perhaps. Then it is, what is the core message of the conversation? What is the big point that we're trying to make? Then we ask, what would you steal? What is one thing you would steal? Then we ask, what is the call to action? And finally, we ask, if they paid you to coach them based on this material, what would you tell them? So how would you make them better if they asked you? Now, here's an important thing, and why I mentioned that is if you just tell people to podwalk, because we discovered this, if you just say, watch the talk, what happens is eventually you'll start going around the room, what did you like about the talk? And three people will say, well, I really liked when you opened with this. And then you go to the person you think didn't watch it, and they'll say, because they learn, oh, I really liked it when he said that thing about the thing. And so now what we do is people come back in. The pod walking would be on a Friday. There is a form on Notion that they fill out. It's super easy. It's just where they put their notes from the conversation, from what they've watched. And then when they come on Monday, we know that everybody has already done it. Now, sure, some people maybe copy and paste, review other people's answers, write something in there. That's more work than watching the 18-minute talk. I say this, that just make sure that the meeting is the catalyst. The learning is not the important thing here. The meeting where the learning will be discussed is the impetus for the work being done. If there is no meeting to discuss it, the work will not be done. It will just be used for something else. We don't need time. We need a deadline. Duke Ellington, Richard Bullhollet.
I actually love the podwalking idea. And the more we talk about it, the more excited I actually get about it. And I think that there's a ton of potential that sits in it. For us to really close this loop, though, I mean, I think we can open up a few more loops inside of it. But for us to just close it for now, what are three questions that people can, if they want to start pod walking? You know, they're listening to this episode today. They go, like, we love this idea. We're going to start pod walking from next week. And we want to have three questions that we can have people think about as they listen to those episodes. What are those three questions?
Richard just told you. Didn't you go back to those six that you just gave? Yeah.
Those were specifically for talks. That's talk breakdown. I want specifically for any sort of generic episode.
But I even think those ones that he mentioned there is what hooked you, what lost you. I also think that's not even just presentation. It's content. It's richness of content. It's almost like, where did you tap out? I was at a talk yesterday and I was watching a chief economist of a bank give a talk. And at some point I got bored. And I looked behind me and most people were on their phones. And I was like, okay, I'm not the only one that you lost me there. You know what I mean? So I think that's a very good question, is what hooked you and what lost you? Those are really good questions. But anyway, Richard, you go ahead. You tell me.
The first thing that we do is that we try and create a context. And so John, that guy, the economist, where he lost people is that what he was talking about no longer felt relevant to them. Okay, so your job when you get on stage, when you start anything, is to fill audiences' gas tanks, their give-a-shit tanks. And if they don't care, you'll lose them, even if it's interesting, because interesting is hard to hold on to unless it's something you care about. So what we do is at the beginning of that, we'll put up a quote and we'll say, how did this, so what is the first, I'm trying to get to, the first question we ask them is basically, how does this matter to our business? So we've just heard this quote. How do you think about this relevant to working at Missing Link? And then, we open up for chat and engagement. So one of the first questions I'd want to ask, at what point did you find an intersection between what they were saying and something that we are doing? So you want people looking for the connection. And it could be on any topic. It could be, well, they were talking about, say last week's episode on heart and positivity. And I feel like the way we engage our clients, sometimes we're more this kind of thing. How do we do that? So you want them actively listening for intersection points with the organization. That's the first thing I would be looking for. Because that way they're going in as investigators, not as passive listeners. And so the questions you get people to work with changes that role. Our staff watch talks as if that question at the end, what would you tell them if they paid you? They're starting watching as coaches. That's very different. The reason most of us tap out is we're engaging as listeners. So you've just got to formulate the questions in such a way that they're investigating and solving for something. Humans want to solve.
Yeah, I like that. I would add the second question is, how does this matter to you? So there's a business component, there's a personal component.
What was the biggest point? That's a very important one for me, because it means you're listening to say, what was the core idea? And that's something that has to unfold over time. You might think it's this. You know how it is. Mm. You might watch a talk and you think the core idea is this, but then you're like, oh, wow, brilliant. The core idea is actually this.
Cool. I like that. I'm happy with those three. All right. So with podwalking all done and wrapped up, all loops closed, tell us a bit about how speaking has changed in the past 21 years from when you started. I see PowerPoint is still there.
I don't think speaking has changed in the last 21,000 years. I think that communication, the principles that the three of us get onto stage, whether we know them or not, when we do a good talk, if you go back far enough, you will find the fingerprints of Socrates and Aristotle and Cicero in all the work that we do. The principles of speaking have not changed. The technological window dressing and other things like that maybe have changed. But a good speech is timeless. And in fact, the biggest problem is that we are in pursuit of novelty. When the anatomy of great speeches, if you look at the world's best speeches, you're always going to go back and you're going to see the tricolons, the anaphoras, the antimetabolies, all of those things. You don't have to know the Greek or the Latin or whatever. You just have to understand the principles. And so I think to me that we should understand that there is novelty at play, but the utility of public speaking, the beautiful thing about public speaking and why public speaking will prevail, is that this is the one skill and discipline that has not only lasted, but has continued to be relevant through every major political, intellectual upheaval, corporate commercial change in the world. The one skill that has never gone out of fashion ever is a leader's ability to communicate.
You're so right. That rhythm has been the same. It's humans. We love that rhythm of the talk. We love it being emotional. We love it being inspirational. We love it being scary, actually, to a certain extent. As I sometimes feel in the audience, not sometimes, every single time I speak, there's a space in my audience where there's a coldness in the room. And it's the dip before we go into the solution. And I almost laugh at it every time because the room's energy just changes because people are like, oh my God. And that's a necessary process. And I think that a lot of speakers want to come out and just give you the top 10 points about something. There's no drama and there's no courage to take an audience through that journey where, they start feeling somewhat negativity in a way to be able to build them up. So yeah, I agree with you. 21,000 years has not changed. And you're so right. That's such a great frame to want to think about it.
Eric, you were going to say there, and then I'll answer.
No, I was going to say even the novelty almost hasn't changed because PowerPoint is still kind of the main tool that people think of when it comes to speaking. Like the moment you think, oh, I have to speak, I think people think PowerPoint is just part of the, it's still part of the, like the legacy of it.
I think the novelty aspect has become much harder for us. I think that every audience member now has watched hundreds of talks, whereas before it was much less. People were, the speaker would be one of the entertainments that we're having maybe that week. Today, anybody that's coming on their way to watch one of our talks most probably has watched two TED Talks and has seen all the top speakers. So the novelty factor, I think, is even more important because people are bored to a certain extent, you know what I mean? And they've got so much information coming at them.
Are you guys familiar with Julian Shapiro?
Yeah, I know him.
Yeah, so Julian.com, he's one of my favorite thinkers, and he talks a lot about writing. And but he's got this principle, and I always like to elegantly articulate different things to try and make them my own. I don't even pretend to make this my own. I think the way he's written this is so perfect that we refer to it as the Shapiro Matrix. And he says that what the most important thing to do, the novelty doesn't come from, if you need the novelty to come from the fact that you're, dancing on stage and dressed funny, well, then you have failed. I'm not saying that you couldn't do those as well, but your talk must be as good as if it was delivered by you sitting down in a plain black suit on a couch and not moving with no slides. But everything after that becomes, it's powerful and it's visual and it's evocative, but you've got to start with the talk. And his novelty is in writing, because I believe that a good speech is written before it's designed, before it's delivered. It's a good speech before you get to the slide phase. Incidentally, if you're starting to work on a speech and you open PowerPoint to start making slides to get your thoughts, you're missing the boat. I get post-it notes, but He talks about the four novelties.
Or if you head to the AI tools these days, right? Like, because so many of them these days, like, just put in like the prompt that you want for like, oh, I want to deliver a leadership talk on actions, not words. And then this AI will design your 10 slides for you with like everything pre-populated.
Well, it's terrible because what AI is very, very good at doing is being very, very, because it's, you know, it's a large language model, as you guys have discussed many, many times. It's going to look at the prevailing amount of information that's out there in the world and say, how do people usually do this? But remember, you got to start under the assumption that the way we usually deliver presentations, the usual presentation is terrible. So it's a very, very small percentage of presentations that are good. So the large language model isn't only looking at what are the good presentations. So it is extremely efficient at creating a very bad presentation. Bad, but acceptable. And that's the biggest problem with public speaking. But it's also your unfair advantage. The, you know, if the acceptable standard for swimming was the same as the acceptable standard for presenting in public, we would drown. There's no two ways about it. So what that means is you just have to put a very small amount of effort in and you're immediately better than everybody else. I say to somebody, we just work on your segues from slide to slide. If that's the only thing I fix, you'll jump. Just getting your segues nailed, I will jump you up by 20 percentile, higher. You'll go up a full grade higher as a speaker to be like, oh, that person was really good. So back to Shapiro. Shapiro has four novelties, and he says you want to open with one of these four novelties. I believe that every single talk should start when you're writing the opening of the talk, and it's in the thing that I write at the beginning. What is my exigence? What is the driving force behind the talk? And then how do I open with clarity and curiosity? That's it. At the end of the beginning of my talk, they need to be clear on what we're discussing, and they need to be curious. Okay, that's it. Like, I'm clear that we're discussing this topic and I'm curious about it. You've created a gap in my knowledge. Now, Shapiro, he talks about, he calls these the novelties. I'd never thought of using that word before, but I like it. And he says there are four novelties. Novelty number one is you've got to be counterintuitive. Novelty number two, counter-narrative. Novelty number three, an elegant articulation. And novelty number four, shock and awe. So briefly, counterintuitive is that you want to say something where people think, wow, I never actually, that's not how I thought that worked. That's quite interesting. Counter-narrative, that's one I lean into a lot. So, for example, I go to war with the idea of personal purpose.
Yeah, I was immediately pegged you into that quadrant as you were going through it.
Totally. So the two that I lean into is counter-narrative and elegant articulation. I know that's my space. So I want to find something that I want to go to war with, and then I want to find an interesting way about saying it. I would do shock and awe as well, and that was as a maybe novelty component at the bottom. And I still think some of that is in there, right? I still say silly, inappropriate things to bring in a little bit of that. Shock and awe for me is kind of surprise and delight, but my content isn't shock and awe. My delivery is maybe shock and awe.
No, yeah, you were. Yeah, that's right. I remember coming to watch you initially, and it was a lot of that, but you've matured because the shock and awe is also like not memorable. You're not waking people up in a way that you want them to. So yes.
The problem, John, just briefly on that, is that the problem is that it's too memorable. So people would come to me years later. The second year I presented a net profit, they actually introduced me as the fuck guy because I swore so much. And people came back to me and, oh, you know, watch your ears and he's got bad language and things like this. And I thought, that's terrible. That's what they remembered. And my favorite bit of content, and I still love it, but my favorite crowd-pleasing, entertaining bit of content was a kind of comedy bit I came up with called the Ninja Drip. And it's the idea that if you're peeing with beige pants, never wear beige pants because when you're peeing, a ninja drip is inside your willy and it will always end up on your pants when you leave the toilet. And I do this whole big theatrical bit about it. And everybody remembered that it was so more memorable. It was such a peak in the emotional amplitude of my talk, which we can address later, that it was too memorable, that it commanded so much of the attention, the shock and awe, that the value that was built into it. So this was the peanut butter, not the pill, but they remembered the peanut butter and they lost the pill. And so that's the mistake with that level of being too entertaining. So
before you get back to the novelties, what was the, like, what was the pill for the ninja drip? I need to know what the lesson was from it.
So the pill was actually falling in hate with something. is that we need to, we've been told to fall in love with something, with an idea, and, you know, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life, which I think is horrific. We should learn to love what we do, but not do what we love. And that's, again, that's an example of a counter-narrative, right? So, because I do think it's a bad thing. Now, sometimes people think that I'm contrarian, but actually I agree with 99% of everything, you know, like that I hear. Like often I'll read something, I think that's smart. And that's why I comment and like and say that's really cool. But I don't talk about the stuff I agree with, because what's the point of saying, oh, Simon Sinek's blah, 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 that's brilliant. Yeah, let me talk about this. There's no value to me personally by leading in with talking about other people's shit. That's for the normies. And so I want to talk about the things that I disagree with. So it's not that I'm contrarian by design. It's that I choose to publicly broadcast my ideas on things where I think it is an important topic that I have a different opinion on. Does that make sense?
Totally.
The next one, very quickly, sorry, because I realize I'm dominating, you know, I'd love your opinions on it. The next one is elegant articulation, and I think it's genius. Elegant articulation, I try bringing in as well. Legicide, that's an elegant articulation of a concept of innovation, right? Because innovation is quite tired and loaded, but legicide is a refresher. I think two examples of elegant articulation. In 1999, a book was written called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. And the basic idea was there's only so many things you can pay attention to. So don't sweat the small things, because they'll just blow your mind. You want to focus on the things that matter. Now, that was a big book. Everyone heard it. Don't sweat the small stuff. Don't sweat the small stuff. Don't sweat the small stuff. Nobody needed to know that. But then in 2016, a guy came out and he wrote a new book with an orange cover. Do you remember what that book was called?
Mark Manson's book.
The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. Yeah, there we go. And that's it. This is an elegant articulation. He said, I want to write a version of this book for maybe, young men. Because that was the audience there, originally. I understand other people have written it, but I've heard him speak about the fact that he wanted to write a book, a self-help book for men that were under-catered. And so he did an elegant articulation of that book. And then, of course, Simon Sinek's beautiful, wonderful, I'm not always a fan, but if you're not a fan of the mastery of rebranding purpose as why and being able to own one of the five biggest words in the English language and literally own that word, you've got your eyes closed. There's no amount of professional jealousy that I have for the man does not give me absolute, complete and utter respect of the appropriation of the word why that he did in 15 minutes. Fuck me, guys. Elegant and shock and awe, you don't need an explanation of that. You know what that is.
So these four are great principles. And again, I think like you said, and maybe this is really just reconfirming all of this for me, is that for 21,000 years, this hasn't changed. I think in the age of AI, we even are craving more human interaction. I think the need for us to engage with people will become even more sort of magnified. How do these four change? What does something get added? Like, what does it look like if you want to project this out and extrapolate it into the future?
So the first thing is, this is just the opening. This is letting you, this to me is a lens that we should be looking at things with. Because the first thing that I wholeheartedly believe that in a world that's plagued by written text and deep faked voice and video, the last bastion of trust, authenticity, and authority is a human being standing on a stage. That cannot be faked, right? It's the last place. It's the last place that you can see a video of Donald Trump and you will not know if it's Donald Trump. You can hear audio of Donald Trump. You will not know if it's audio. You can read a tweet of his. You will not know if he said it. But if he's standing up in front of us, doing a silly little dance, wearing his funny hat, saying these things, then you know it's him. Like him or hate him, that's the reality. If you are a human that you want to make an impact in the world today, in a world that is driven by inauthentic text and communication, and I, by the way, I'm a big fan of it. It's not that I don't think, I think it's making me better. I'm very, very fond of AI, but I recognize the position that it's given me, that it has increased the value attributed to public speaking. And it's not just AI. It's actually the shortening of attention spans. It's actually TikTok as well. Because where else in the world, right, do you have when you get on stage, when they said to you, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome John and Eric. When you walk onto that stage after that nice bio, your authority is established. It's yours to lose. Anybody given a stage, a microphone on a stage, the authority is assumed. So you have this one medium in the world where you have two things simultaneously. You have amplified authority and you have extended attention. 45 minutes of human attention at high authority states. Guys, anyone not leaning into this is playing with one arm tied behind their back.
Yeah, what a privilege. Yeah.
Wow. I love how you explain that. And it's, you know, I often talk about that the biggest compliment that you can get or see is people not checking their phones while you're on stage. And that is, you know, that is a very difficult thing to get right, because even in a movie, you're like, let me just quickly check what's going on with WhatsApp or something, you know?
I saw a wonderful, so I was in Creativity World Forum in Antwerp, maybe 12 years ago. And John Cleese was the opening speaker. He was speaking about creativity. And it was kind of cool tech event. And one of the things you all had was these handsets. Remember when before you could vote on your phone, you'd vote on handsets and things like this. But this one had an accelerometer in it. And the accelerometer was linked to this kind of moving, murky thing that was on the side of the stage. It was this like pink line. And it was a small, you know, those like small little moving dots. But as they go bigger and more chaotic. And so it was one of those things. And the MC turned around and said, if the speaker says anything that you really, really like, shake the controller and let them know. And John Cleese broke it in 2 seconds. But I thought it was perfect. He walked on, he said, no. In a calm way, he said, if you're aware enough to want to shake the thing, it's because I've lost you. He said, I would like to ask you something different. If at any given time I've bored you and I've lost you and you find yourself not paying attention to it, then I want you to shake your controller because I want to know to win you back. In that net profit, there used to be those Twitter streams at the side. And I walked onto the stage and I went up and I said, no, please, guys. And I didn't ask permission. I said, please, can you turn the Twitter stream off? Because I've sat here all day long and instead of people listening to talks, they're trying to see how smart and funny other people are on the Twitter stream. It's a distraction. You're here to listen. By all means, tweet if you want to, but I will feel that I've done well, not if there's a lot of tweets, but if there's few.
Yes, 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 yes. Yes.
So maybe as we then just look, you know, in terms of, let's just say like the actual theatrics of keynote speaking, because I think the principles remain the same. So you have these principles that are, you know, that haven't changed in the past 21,000 years. It's really about the art of communication, but then there's the presentation of it still. There's the theatrical component that comes with it. How do you think that changes? I've seen some speakers use like 3D type sort of projections and stuff, you know, and obviously it just raises the novelty of it. But what do you think happens in that space?
So I do think that it's nice to find great ways of doing things, right? Jamie Oliver bringing on that, do you remember he brought that big wheelbarrow full of sugar and he poured it onto the TED stage, or Bill Gates opened the jar and let the mosquito out into the TED audience. So they understood what it feels like to live with malaria in Africa. Those kind of things are fantastic. They're wonderful and beautiful. But the first question to ask yourself, and I don't want to derail this part of your conversation, but for most people, because it sounds more fun and exciting to think about this, but if you don't understand logos, pathos, and ethos, if you don't, those terms I gave you, anti-metabole, anaphora, a tricolon, if those are completely alien to you, start with that. Do start with the principles. We believe that there's a skill versus system curve. And I want you to imagine a quadrant of four areas, right? High skill, high system, low system. You know what I'm trying to say there. A lot of speakers, when we're trying to work with them, the harder ones to train for us are the high skill, low system. Because they get off stage and everyone says, oh, you were brilliant because you were funny and they were this. And the audience loved it and they laughed the whole way through, but they didn't change anything. Ironically, one of the best, most loved TED Talks of all time, I think is a bad presentation, and that's Ken Robinson. I don't think it was a good talk. I don't think he made his case well at all, that schools are killing creativity. I mean, I could have an entire episode with you explaining, well, show me the body. The creativity, we live in the most creative time in human history. So, and, you know, people graduated from school. But anyway, high skill, super enjoyable, very funny, very quirky, all of these things. But actually, he rambled. He spoke quite a bit of shit all the way throughout it. If I asked you to talk about the principles of the talk, I don't think many people would remember it. They just remember having fun with it. He's actually very hard to coach. If I went to somebody like Bill Gates, who's not a great speaker, but they understand the narrative structure. In fact, the example we often use is Elon Musk. Elon Musk's talks are terrible to watch, and yet you're on the hook and you want the product. It's so weird. We showed Missing Link's stuff when he launched that Powerwall. Remember the kind of the battery for your garage? We ran it as a talk teardown. And so I asked my staff, you know, what do you think? And shit is shocking. Somebody else advanced his slides. He didn't, no emotional amplitude. He didn't, blah, blah, blah. And they shredded it. And then I said, who in the room doesn't want the power wall? Who in the room doesn't want the power wall? And everybody wanted the wall. And I said, okay, so how is it a bad talk? And then I said, let's map this with our framework. Give them a reason to care. Give them a reason to believe. Tell them what they need to know. Tell them what they need to do. His structure was perfect. His delivery was terrible. So that's why we still listen to him, because his narrative structure was good. There's no novelty. The novelty is the product. So any novelty he brings is beyond the product. It steals from the product. So that, I think, is the important place to start. Once we have that, though, I'm constantly looking for better ways, because I think 50% of my job is to inform and 50% is to entertain. So in every single talk, I'm looking for the areas where, oh, this is deep but boring. How can I bring some more excitement and entertainment into it? And you guys?
How many different talks do you have, Richard, that are?
So what I've done is I've rebranded all my talks. So I have too many because I've been, you know, speaking for a while, and I've made the very big mistake of speaking about two broad topics. This is why I'm not as successful as you, right? It's because I've made it, well, so that's actually unfair to say. There's many reasons for that. You've been more intentional about your marketing, more intentional about your branding, more intentional about your positioning, and it's been brilliant. So I'm in awe, and you know I look up to you in many, many ways there. But me speaking about, you know, negotiation and decision-making and all of these things makes it very, very hard for people to find me. So if they know me, they'll book me. But if they don't, I'm not an expert for them. So as an aside. So now what I have is I have my core talk, Relentless Relevance. And then I have a few variations of that talk, which is Relentless Relevance for salespeople, Relentless Relevance for customer service, Relentless Relevance for leaders. And those actually go back to my previous talks, Why Leaders Fail, Slaying Sales Dragons, Hacking the Expectation Engine. So at any given time, I've got a business talk, a talk around people. I've got a talk that could be for more retail. So I have talks for different areas, but now all of them come back to the idea, the core middle premise of being relentlessly relevant, at least for now.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about corporates, it's really just about sales, leadership, culture, and future. Is there anything else you think corporates are looking for? It's like those four topics, like you want better leaders, you want better culture, you want to have a better future strategy, and you want more sales. Like
further down the food chain, you've got process, but that's generally not a keynote's job. But there is a definite tier for speakers who can handle the process thing. But you're right. I think that is it. At the top of it, those are, you're spot on. I love that.
Yeah. Those four, like I always think about, like when an event organizer is going through choosing a speaker, she's got in her mind, or he's got in her mind, this is the event is about customers, or the event is about our leaders. And so we're always looking for those key words to want to tick them off. You know, I think that's why it's so important to have them within the title.
I think the future is one that probably has to, the future now, if you want to be somewhat successful, it's, you should exist on the intersection of one of those and the future. Because
yes,
we do want future-facing content. We do want to be thinking about where the world is going. And so, you know, that's where maybe I got also a bit up my own arse in the past, is that I didn't want to be about that because I love history. And so I wanted to kind of learn from the past, but I didn't market myself enough with the application to the future. And I think now if you're a professional speaker, you are a degree of a futurist in many ways. You're offering the opinion of—
You have to be, yeah. Yeah. I've seen some speakers become futurists overnight. Their LinkedIn's changed. I hate the term futurist, and I get categorized in that because of my link to singularity. But the idea is that most of us are futurists. You know, I think it's a natural inclination. If you're a if you're a thinker, you're thinking about the future, trying to bring the past into the future and creating a different version of it, you know? So I think it's a great, it's something to definitely keep in mind that you want to be able to always leading to the future, whatever those topics that you're talking about, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And because it's funny, the term is loaded, but it's helpful and it works. But I think that just to be a futurist now is not enough. Because we need to get narrower. People want to know, okay, so you're thinking about the future, and the future with regards to retail in commercial real estate. You know, this is the kind of the more of those intersection points you get, the more likely you are to be booked. In South Africa, you can be a generalist, but in the US, they want somebody who's, you know.
Look, the way I've sort of, because, you know, you often get organizations asking you to talk about the specificity of their skill, like tell us the future of insurance or tell us the future of customer centricity, get us all those sort of things. And I always find it a little bit difficult to want to even go in with any sort of understanding, because they spend their lives in that world. It's very difficult to want to pick up nuggets that they might not know. So the way I've angled it is to give them a framework in which they could ask themselves better question about the topic that they want to be thinking about.
The way I handle this always is metaphor and distance management. I can't remember if I've spoken to you guys about this before, but the more I've been thinking, it was actually like an epiphany in a jiu-jitsu lesson one day. But I realized that all story and metaphor exists for only one of two purposes. We tell a story for the purpose of distance management. So if I'm speaking to a group of people in financial services, if the client said to me, oh, you want to speak to people, we want some real good financial service examples, I say, well, hold on a second. What I'm trying to do is get a principle into them. What I need to do is to create distance. Because if I attack them where they are, they have way more knowledge in that space for me, and then they'll defend it. Mm. So what I want to do is I want to create some distance, bring some case studies there, get them to understand this from a distance. And then once they agree, then I can say, so why would that be different in financial services?
Yeah.
Surely in such and such and such. And I have spoken to this in the pre-meeting about this. And then they do that and they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And that checks the client's box. On the flip side though, is I might have a concept that is too far away from them. So I want to talk to them about, like, John, some of the stuff you talk about is quite, like, people have never heard it before. So you'll be talking about something in a state, this kind of theta space that somebody might exist in. You'd have to start and say, well, I got to get them closer. So what you're going to do is you're going to close the gap. You're going to say, let me explain this to you in a way you understand. When you take off on a plane and you get off on a plane, you know how they talk to you about cruising altitude and different altitudes and things like this. I want you to imagine the altitudes as states, as mental states in your brain. So now they can link it to something. So you've brought the topic closer to them to start. And so that's how I try and will tie it back into often their concept. Instead of me trying to act like an insider, because I'm not.
No, you can't be. No, and you can't be. And I think it's dangerous to come in as an insider, because you really shoot yourself in the foot. And I've done that. I've done that for a talk for Reuters in Dubai, and I lost them. And I was on stage and I could feel I was losing them, because I thought I was a specialist for Reuters. I mean, think about that. A little pipsqueak coming to talk to Reuters about the future of media. Come on, bro. Like, catch yourself.
My lost story was doctors, speaking to doctors about communication. And I was trying to explain to them, and, you know, they're so regulated. They have so many things that they can and cannot say, that me trying to act like that. So I just went back to, it's not about how you communicate, but let me talk to you about how human beings can process information. I can't tell you about legal communication, but I can talk to you about how humans process information. That's all I'm doing. And so I had to create distance because I looked like an idiot. The caveat to that is if you are an expert. So if you were a doctor or you were from Reuters, then you can lean into your insidership.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's such a great way of explaining it. You know, I call it this brain state. I call it the holiday effect, because brain waves, people don't really understand the theory, but you understand how different you are when you're on holiday and when you're actually at work, because it's like, you know what happened to you on holiday? Your brainwave changed. And this is the brainwave I was talking about. And the minute you get back to work, your brainwave changed. And so now your whole personality is based on the level of stress you have, based on the environment you're in, which means you can't be creative in a space of stress. So this is exactly, you're so right. It's like, and yeah.
I want you to think about that. I promise you it's going to, once I had the aha moment, It was literally in a jiu-jitsu class. Once I had the aha moment, and now I see it everywhere. The next time you're writing content, you'll see. All you got to ask yourself is, do I need to create space or do I need to close distance? And you'll realize that all story and metaphor is that. And you start seeing it everywhere. And as of yet, those are the only two reasons I can see for metaphor and case study.
Yeah, that's great. I really like that. So let's close off. I mean, this is a lot of information and I'm loving it. As we move into this world of AI and as we move into this world of, you know, just chaos ahead of us with IQs, you know, I don't know if you know this, but right now ChatGPT 4.5 has got an IQ of 155, which is Einstein. It's doubling every 6 months or so. So by the end of the year, we should be at 310. By next year, mid next year, it'll be on 600. And so we're moving into a world with this incredible level of IQ that we are getting access to. I believe that storytelling will become even more important and even more needed in a space like that. But I find it difficult to get my head around people having access to that level of intelligence in their pockets. Like the marrying of having that level of intelligence available to you and then the storytelling, I think that the thing that I think is becoming more and more and more important is your very authentic angle and surprising and delighting the audience in ways that they're not expecting it to. Because already with YouTube and already with TED Talk, you've kind of seen everything. It's like you've already seen all these processes. So talk to us a little bit about that uniqueness, that authenticity, that level of trust in the world of hyperintelligence.
One of the things I've always said to people, you know, one of the first lines I say to you about public speaking is know your audience. But how can you? How can you? Like you can sit in front of that group of people from Reuters and you, one of them is, polygamist. One of them is this, one of them is that, one of them is a thief. One of them is we absolutely cannot because organizations are complex and humans are complex. And so what you can know about an audience is that every single audience has the most finely tuned bullshit detector. And that they will pick up. And that's exactly what happened to me in the doctor's meeting and you in the Reuters meeting, tuned bullshit detectors were like, this guy doesn't understand media. But actually, if they realize, oh, but they're an expert in X. And so this is where authenticity is. Why I get away with being cheekier than most speakers. The person I bring to a stage is the version of me I am in a dinner party with people I love when I'm telling a story. And I used to think I was inauthentic when I was this larger than life character on stage. And then I realized, no, I'm in there. That's it. I want to bring that person of me. I want to bring the person of me that you'd find on Broadway, not in a boardroom. But to go back to what we said earlier, as leaders, you know, the people that listen to this pod, they listen because they're intellectual leaders to some degree. This is our job. When you have an intellectual being at an IQ of 600, your teams and people do not understand how to synthesize that. Leadership for me only exists in liminality. The only time that leadership is required is in times of change and flux, right? The rest of the time we need a manager. The good news is that we're now in permanent state of flux. So that means that the call to you is to be this interface. The world is changing so quickly that somebody needs to make sense of this with our teams. And this is the job. And then the second thing is the way to stand yourself out, right? I refer to it as stage marketing. If you can stand on stage, like the number one product that we're selling at Missing Link at the moment is CEOs and entrepreneurs wanting us to write speeches for them. They recognize this role of thought leadership. I don't believe you can call yourself a manager, you can call yourself a CEO, but if you're not standing in front of the other humans and speaking to them, you are not a leader. And the future needs the ones that will. We need more human, we need more AI human interfaces. For the level of learning we're about to go through, fuck me, it's so huge, it's so exciting that we need leaders who can synthesize this for us.
I love what you're saying there, but also one thing you just said, Naz, you want to be the Richard at a dinner party on stage. And so when you say that, do you mean you have different versions of you as an authentic Richard, but that you're almost taking a role? Like I remember listening to a podcast and the guy was like, every superhero has something that pushes them into that character. And they were asking about you slipping into these characters, like the warrior or the entertainer, whatever it may be. So when you say authentic, are you playing around that aspect of who you are to want to show up on stage?
So guys, I consider both of you very, very close friends. And both of you have been very indulgent on allowing me to bring this version of myself to the podcast. Because the truth of the matter is, when I sit down and have a coffee with both of yours, it's a much more introspective, toned down, emotional, thoughtful, I hope, version of myself. And but I recognize that I have a job to do here today, that I'm here to try and add some sort of thoughts and opinions and things. And I do that by trying to create, you know, I've mentioned the term emotional amplitude twice. The idea that a talk should not exist on a flat line. John, you spoke about getting people down into the dip so you can build them up. This amplitude that exists in a talk, I'm trying to bring that to the podcast. Now, I can't do that if I'm being the friend that I would be in a conversation with you. So I've had to understand the different states that I am. And I think that if we call them the three states, there's the me state. There's maybe the fourth one is the stranger state, right? We all have that. It's the polite, kind of fun version of yourself that exists for other people, that's protecturing. Then you have this, which is kind of a broadcast state for me, which is slightly heightened. And then I've got my stage state. And my stage state I recognize as a performance. It's a performance state. But the thing is, I'm performing as Richard Mulholland, the speaker and intellectual and thinker. I'm performing as me, and I'm doing my best to present who I am so that when people know me, they don't think you're so different to what I thought. They can join the dots and find their way back as they get to know me better, from the person I am on stage to the person I am when I'm chatting to them. And that's where authenticity comes in, and that's what gives me permission to be a little bit cheeky and swear and do some shock and awe things, because people recognize that I'm just being myself. Because I think this is an important point on knowing the audience. Too many people try and speak at the level of their audience. This is terrible. What you have to do is bring the audience to the level of you. In the land of Eric and the land of John and the land of Richard, we are the best version of ourselves that exist. So, and I'm sure I've told you the story before, but the first time I did a big EO gig, it was in Guadalajara. It was to the presence of all the South American and North American chapters. And I was very, very nervous. The first thing, it was actually on my son's birthday. It was the first time I'd ever missed it. So the first thing I did, I walked on stage, said, guys, I'm so sorry. I nearly didn't make it here. I nearly said no to this, but I really wanted to make a difference as an EO member, a fellow member. Ooh, this is an entrepreneur, a connection, commonplace. Then what I turned around and said was, but also in order to be here today, the reason I wasn't going to come is my son's birthday. Can we all sing happy birthday? Everybody sang happy birthday. So now I'm a dad, commonplace. Okay, so we've now connected father, the entrepreneur, EO member. We had three common places that we have in common. Now I needed to do the real work of saying, okay, we have this much in common. I'm one of your people, but now I need you to bring me to me. So I said, it was so funny. On the way here, I was watching the movie The Hangover in the plane. Have you guys seen it? And I smiled at them and they smiled back. And because that's how they think. And I think, well, let me tell you, I remember that scene where Mr. Chow jumped out of the back of the can you all remember? And then they all start laughing because you remember him jumping out with his little willy dangling around. And I said, okay, cool. Nothing I tell you in this talk is going to be as offensive, as crazy as anything that you saw in that movie and you're laughing and smiling about it. So then I reset the audience that the expectation was measure me against The Hangover, not against the corporate presenter that came before you. And then I had them. So I brought them to my land and I could communicate as me. The mistake I see idiot speakers make is that they go in there and they're like, oh, it's a series of bankers. Hello there. Good day to you. My name is Richard Mulholland. Yeah. And today I'd like to talk to you about. Oh.
Poof. Jeez, that bothers me. I consider that I have to leave the conference. I can't actually watch it. It's so cringe for me. It's so bad. This has been excellent. Excellent, excellent. I've absolutely loved it. Thank you so much for all your wisdom and all your insights. And, you know, I'm always impressed by how deeply you think about things. And I always think to myself, geez, dude, you got to start thinking deeper about these things. But this is always what I feel. I feel inspired and I also feel I need to work harder. And I think both those things are really important. I remember when I was a bodybuilder, when I was 19, I entered competitions and I used to go watch the bigger guys. And I used to always walk away thinking, geez, I got to train harder. And I'm inspired, but I've got to work so much harder. And it's always the emotion I get when I spend time with you, Richard. So thank you for sharing all your wisdom and all your insights, Eric.
Yeah, I will just echo that. Thanks a lot for your time again, dude. Always good to hang out with you. We are actually closing out the pod with a quote for the week every week now. Do you have a quote like top of mind that you can riff and give to us?
In any field, in the world, an expert who can communicate will have an unfair advantage over an expert who cannot.
Richard Mulholland. Richard Mulholland.
Yeah. There we go. an original, yeah, an original Richard.
Yeah, that was an OG. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Guys, I just want to say as well.
Amazing.
I know you know this, and I know that I've kind of overspoken here, but you know that I feel the exact same way. I'm a fan of the show and a listener of the show because I come to learn from you as well. And every time I'm with you both, I walk away feeling equally inspired. So thank you for letting me turn the tables a wee bit today. I really, really appreciate that you've allowed me so much space.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And look, here's an intention for the three of us. And the three of us, we know we need to share a stage together. That's the next thing that we need to be intending, a live stage together. So that'd be great.
Why don't we just run an event? So here's what we're pitching. We're pitching the Expansive Day. Let people know in the comments on social media if we can pitch an event where it's a half-day event, where it's a full keynote by the three of us, along with some other thinkers and guests. And I think it'll be very exciting.
We have some plans, Richard, so we'll be in touch about that.
Then don't ignore what I just said.
No, don't worry. They're in the plans. And the flats.
Amazing. As always, thank you for listening to The Expansive. We love having you with us and tuning in for this special episode of The Expansive Friends. As always, you know, if you found value in this, we'd love for you to leave a review on the pod. Share with us your ideas, share with us your insights that you get from this as well. And we think that there's a ton that you can apply from this into your own roles as leaders. And until next time, be expensive.
Ciao.
Cheers.